Miranda Hart burst into our living rooms in 2009 with her semi-autobiographical, multi-award-winning television sitcom, Miranda. Her irrepressible physical comedy and willingness to make fun of herself quickly endeared her to audiences as she battled through socially awkward situations, particularly dating. She also had to deal with her overbearing mother while popularizing phrases like "such fun," "keep calm," and "gallop on," and "bear with." She then took a leading role in the BBC drama series Call the Midwife as Chummy, Camilla Fortescue Chumley Brown, and appeared in films including Emma, playing Jane Austen's chatterbox, Miss Bates. Her recent memoir, I Haven't Been Entirely Honest With You, describes how she lived for years with undiagnosed Lyme disease and the lessons that she's learnt. She calls them treasures on her journey from illness to recovery. Miranda, you've brought some wonderful music today, including Grieg, Bach, Bizet, but I think we're going to begin with Mozart.
Lovely. And can I just say, you said such fun beautifully.
Why this particular piece?
The Mozart makes me think of my mother and father, actually, who introduced me to classical music. I can remember hearing that in my childhood bedroom upstairs, wafting up from below. And then as an adult, I fell in love with it more from watching Out of Africa and seeing Meryl Streep and Robert Redford with this music. I think I'm a romantic at heart. And I understand, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but this is one of Mozart's final pieces, which makes it even more moving for me.
And the other extraordinary thing about it is that the clarinet was only invented in his lifetime. So he was basically writing this masterpiece for an instrument that he didn't even know as a child.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, I'm going to sound far more knowledgeable about classical music than I genuinely am, because I just Googled this. But apparently he said it reminded him of a voice, of his friend's voice. I just think that's beautiful.
I notice you've chosen more than one adagio.
Have I?
Yes. This is where we begin to find out the little secrets through the music.
Okay.
But I think it's interesting that people do concentrate on something at a certain speed because it speaks to them.
Yeah, I think I've recently realised a part of me is being melancholic and that I can accept that. That melancholy doesn't have to mean, it doesn't mean depressed. It's actually a place where I find joy and relaxation.
And it can be cathartic, can't it?
Very cathartic. Mm. So I've quite enjoyed accepting that melancholy part of me, or that deep thinking part of me, or just expression of those, what I was brought up to believe were not so good emotions, I now fully embrace and enjoy.
Thank you. It has a huge range, the clarinet.
Yeah, I know. I was thinking how low that was. It's amazing. And listening to it with that thing that I now know, but just Googled, about him seeing it as a voice, it definitely, you hear it in a different way. And it almost feels like a real ending of a voice just finishing its time on earth, a sort of sense of longing.
The Adagio from the Concerto for Clarinet and Orchestra in A Major by Mozart, performed by Annelian van Valver on the clarinet with the North German Radio Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Andrew Manzi. That's quite a nice cue to lead into a little bit more about your early life, Miranda Hart. You grew up in Hampshire.
Yes, born in Devon. So it was the first 2 years of my life there. My father was a naval captain down there.
Did you know much about his life at sea?
No, not really. I was obviously aware of his 3, 6, 9 month absences at times. It was very much my mother was focus in my life. But his ship was actually sunk in the Falklands. He was captain of HMS Coventry, and I remember that moment coming back from school and suddenly this press being around and thinking, what's going on? My mum having to tell us, because it took 24 hours for her to find out whether he was still alive. But luckily, I wasn't traumatically affected by that. Yeah. But we'll obviously never forget that.
His ship was hit by 2 bombs and sadly capsized in 20 minutes with the loss of 19 men. Did your father ever talk about this with you?
Yeah, he actually inadvertently, I think, dealt with the trauma of it very well by speaking about it a lot and sort of letting the tears flow. And he pressed a tape recorder and recorded it all for himself as well, which later became a book. So I think he just processed it and got it all out. And he'll cry if it's mentioned now, but in a very healthy way.
And your mother, Diana Dee, she must have been pretty stoical about these things.
She is amazingly stoic. She's incredibly resilient, my mother. She's fun and creative, and I think I get some silliness from her as well, probably from both of them. But, yeah, she's got an extraordinary strength.
And is she like or unlike the character played by Patricia Hodge in Miranda?
I'm pleased to say unlike. My poor mum, I think when the first series came out, she struggled a bit with people thinking that that was her. But no, my mum does not look down on me or disparage me in such a way.
And what about some of those phrases, such fun?
That may have come from her and some friends. Yes, I think some phraseology in general, sort of. My mother's a gardener, so there was lots of sketches about gardening and all the ridiculous language around it and some of that sort of upper-class way and tradition. But yes, the character as a whole is not her.
And did she also enjoy music?
Yes, she still plays piano to this day and was actually doing grade 8 piano when she was pregnant with me. Oh. And I learnt classical piano when I was younger but was notoriously bad at sight reading. And one day my mother suddenly heard this tune being played on the piano and she rushed in and looked quite Ashton and said, where did you get that? What do you play? Are you learning that? And I said, no, I just found it. Shit, that's the grade 8 piece that I played when I was pregnant with you over and over and over again. And I just could sight read it like that.
It's extraordinary. And we know now that hearing music at that age, in the womb even, has a quite extraordinary effect on people. Calming, in fact.
Yeah. Although I don't know if practicing for grade 8 and going over and over and over piece of music, but I do know that I could sight read it straight off. Mm.
The next piece of music is not from grade 8. It's a duet, I think.
The Pearlfishers duet. Now, I'm here to ask you about this, because I was going to say ashamed to say, but no, I'm not. It's just the way it is. I've yet to see an opera. Mm. I know very little about opera, but I love choirs, I love harmonising, I love hearing voices. And I've always found opera a bit funny, a bit like ballet. I just can't help but see the comedic side.
But you're in common with lots of other people. I mean, no less a person said on this programme, David Hare, that he couldn't take it.
Right. Now,
for other people, when it all comes together, orchestra, singers, all the stagecraft, it does something absolutely magnificent. And I have a feeling you would enjoy it.
Yeah, I'm sure I would, because I'm a sucker for musicals. So I don't know where the delineation I make between musicals and opera is. But this, whenever it's played, I just melt. I think it's absolutely beautiful. And the harmonies, again, hard to explain what they do to me. But I'd love you to tell me what it's about, because for all I know, they could be talking to each other about, I've just had a delicious ham sandwich, because I'm no linguist at all. So sometimes you're like, I'd love to know what they're actually saying.
Basically, it's about 2 men declaring they will have lifelong friendship and nothing will come between them. But guess what? Love.
love
comes between them. They both fall in love for the same woman.
Not with a ham sandwich, but a woman. probably a better story.
Oh.
Au fond du temple saint from Act One of The Pearlfishers by Georges Bizet, performed by the tenor Luciano Pavarotti and the baritone Nikolai Giaurov, with the National Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Robin Stapleton.
Oh, did you see me conducting?
Yes. You were rising up above it on those
was
phrases.
Yes, I know that I was. It's just instinctual.
You were at a boarding school called Down House. Did you enjoy it?
I loved it. Mm. I know a lot of people, when the phrase school was the best days of your life, people go, what? So ridiculous. But for me, they were, actually. I loved the structure of boarding school. I was sporty, so that was on tap all the time. I loved the friendship being on tap. I loved breaking against the hierarchy a bit and being silly in the class count. It just suited me perfectly. Life went downhill when I left school.
I think the sports presenter Claire Balding was there at the same time as
Yeah, she was my head girl.
Was she a nice head girl?
She was very nice, very efficient, very nice.
What else?
I have to say that. There she is. And it's been nice to get to know her, you know, more recently. Yeah, she's great.
And then political science at university?
Yeah, I'm going to say political science is very much heavy inverted commas. It's not what I wanted to do, and it didn't suit me very well. But I scraped by a 2-1, I don't know how. And I started writing sketches then.
And did you begin to act at that point?
It wasn't until I was about 26 that I admitted that I wanted to act. It took me a long time to say it.
So what gave you the idea that that might be something that you'd be good at?
Gosh, I had no idea I'd be good at it, but it was just something that I was passionate about since I was 7 or 8, watching Morecambe and Wise. I saw them on the telly and I can remember, even at aged 8, saying, laughter is a serious business, there has to be more of it in the world and I want to play for a living. I think it's one of the bravest things to say, I'm going to try and make someone laugh. But it was just too important a thing for me in my bones to not dare try it. And one Edinburgh festival I said, right, I don't know if I'm going to try and do this for a living, but if I get one audience of over 20 people and one okay review, then I'll carry on. And we did a week, and most of the nights we got 3 people. One time we had to cancel because we got no one. No one was reviewing us. And then on the penultimate day, we got 21 people and a 3-star review in The Scotsman. So it's that Scotsman's fault and my cousin for bringing all her university friends along.
Well, the next music really stems from that experience of watching Morecambe and Wise.
Yeah, this has to be, if someone goes, what's your favourite song? This would have to be it because it's so formative.
Bring me sunshine.
Don't ruin it, Michael.
Bring me sunshine in your smile. Make me happy all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness, so much joy we can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love. Hop the bubble doo da today. Hop the bubble doo doo doo. Bring me sunshine in your smile.
In your smile.
Make me happy.
Make me happy.
All the while.
All the while.
In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy we can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy.
Make
bring me love.
Not only had you singing, but dancing.
Yeah, it was my husband who introduced me to the Jive Aces who did that. And that will get me up off the floor and I'll lose any self-consciousness and dance. Just love it. It's got a timeless quality to it as well.
It moves so effortlessly from a sort of lyrical song into an upbeat song.
Yeah, it sort of tricks you. You think you're just going to stay in that same bit, and then suddenly it changes too.
I was going to give you another example, but I think after your rudeness earlier,
I couldn't be more sorry, sir.
Bring Me Sunshine, composed by Arthur Kent and Sylvia Dee, performed there by the Jive Aces Ensemble. So, did it take a long time to break into comedy? Did you get any sort of lucky breaks?
Absolutely no lucky breaks whatsoever. I went to the Edinburgh Festival every August for 11 years. Every year I would leave my temping job in July and say, goodbye, I'm bound to get my big break now. And by mid-September I'd be back going, is the job still open? So it took a long time, but I'm pleased it did now because I really got to hone my craft and I ended up honing this Miranda character that I did in stand-up on stage. But it was pretty gruelling to have 15 years before I got to pitch something for the BBC. I was sort of tired before I began, but a great training ground.
And how did you find the writing process? Did it come easily or was it hard won?
For me, it was a hard one. I'm so passionate about studio audience sitcoms, about sitcoms as a genre. And I also just thought, well, this will just be one series and that'll be that. So I worked incredibly hard to sort of get the structure and the technique of sitcom as well as I could. And I actually wrote it very much with music in mind. So I'd often, on my own in my kitchen, sort of conduct it and make sure that the rhythm, there was a bit of staccato joke there, or then it went a bit slow. I very much wrote it as a graph and music. But then I ended up getting a second series, and that's when the hard work really, really began. But when you're filming in front of a studio audience, you've got to get a laugh, and regularly, and that's the tough thing.
And it must be difficult too, because presumably you can't do lots of retakes because it isn't so funny the third time.
No, and also you've got the studio audience in there from, I think they come in about 7, we start recording at 7:30, and really you've got a maximum of 3 hours. It's quite tough. So we usually did a maximum of 2 takes, and you only get about 3 days rehearsal as well before, so it's a unique discipline, but I love it.
Another adagio, Miranda.
Well, you see, I'm either silly or melancholic. There's nothing in between with me. Bonkers or deep.
What is this?
This is a bark, and I got this from watching Truly Madly Deeply, Juliet Stevenson in that film, and I thought, I want to be an actor. And this was a key piece of music of her pining for her recently deceased husband. And so for me, again, it's got that sort of deep, deep longing, which I'm beginning to accept as a part of this bittersweet life we live. It's beautiful. And I don't normally like Bach because it makes me think of drinks parties. It's all a bit sort of polite and twinkly. Is that really rude of me?
I think after we've finished, I'm going to have to give you a little list to go and weigh and
okay, good.
Change
yes,
some
would
of your
you?
Minds. Operas you must see, bits
yes.
of Bach which are highly emotional.
Great. I mean, that would be lovely. I'd love that because I see it all as polite drinks parties, which is not me, as you've probably gathered.
Thank you.
We heard the Adagio from the Sonata No. 3 in G minor for cello and piano by Bach, performed by Daniel Müller-Schott and Angela Hewitt. I know why I think Miranda was so popular, but why do you think it was so popular, Miranda Hart?
Oh, what an interesting question. I think one of the reasons is its warmth. I think warmth is very rare in television, particularly in comedy. There's a sort of authenticity to it.
And there was always a vein of romance running through it as well, which added to the warmth.
I mean, she was this woman who longed to be herself, which actually ended up what my recent book ended up being about, that my sitcom character had sort of found who she truly was, and she could therefore be with the person she loved. And I thought then I was there myself, but actually 10 years later I find I now am more honestly and freely and authentically myself in a way I didn't think I needed to be. Can you indulge me in why you think it was good, or was that just a phrase?
Various reasons. I think certainly that humanity, I think everybody could respond to it in terms of their own life.
Okay.
Not always quite as disastrously. I'm glad to say.
Yes, so but
you know, we've all been there, or to bits of it.
Yes.
And also, I just love the way you kind of broke that fourth wall and sometimes spoke to the camera as though you were sharing an intimacy with us.
Right. Well, thank you very much for that indulging moment.
And of course, there was a lot of physical comedy too, wasn't there? Was it hard to get that right?
Yeah, it was actually. Again, that feels quite like music, like you're conducting. So, yeah, I used to practice the different ways to fall off a bar stool or work out which way is funnier. Obviously, Eric Morecambe taught me how to break the fourth wall and look cheekily down camera. But I wanted to bring that old Variety Hall, perhaps I was born in the wrong generation, but old Variety Hall entertainment back.
Do you remember when they had Previn on and called him Andrew Preview?
Yes. Yes, I do. Hence the Grieg coming up later.
You were nominated and won numerous awards for the show, including 3 at the British Comedy Awards in 2010. So was that a moment for you where you felt, gosh, this thing has worked?
Yeah, that was very surreal. Very surreal. I think at that moment, you're sort of slightly rabbit in headlights thinking, what is going on? Slightly out-of-body experience meeting all these famous people off the telly, which you don't consider yourself. I remember meeting Paul McCartney backstage at the 2012 Jubilee, and he sort of looked at me and kind of went like, sort of waved, and I was just staring at him, thinking I was invisible, and sort of looked behind me thinking, who's he waving at? And he came over to me and he said, have you forgotten that I have a telly? And I went, oh, yes, I'm on telly. And he says, this happens to me all the time. So I think you're slightly like, what's going on? Mm. But hopefully you took it enough in my stride and coped.
One of the things that you're known for is your body positivity. Where did that come from?
Yeah, that came probably from an experience I had in my 20s. Which I was an athlete when I was younger, obviously very lean, and for illness reasons put on 5 stone in 2 years. And so my whole identity changed. And there was a lot of shame in that, and there was a lot of embarrassment that being a bigger woman wasn't right. All that sort of old narrative that's in our DNA, that bigger is lesser, if you pardon. So part of the sitcom was celebrating women of all kinds. So I think that's where it came from, noticing how I carried this shame of being a bigger woman.
Well, the next piece of music, not connected to what we've been talking about.
Listen, I know what's coming up. It's quite a funny segue.
It's from The Carnival of the Animals, and you're going to tell us which one it is.
The animal I've chosen, the elephant, and that is not connected to the previous mention of weight gain. Obviously, I probably could have chosen the swan because it's the most famous one, and it is beautiful.
Which would have been more appropriate.
Yes, thank you. But the elephant's my favourite animal. But actually, the reason I've chosen The Carnival of the Animals was that I discovered that he was meant to be writing something else when he wrote this. And he said, sorry, I can't stop doing this because this is such fun. And that's what I get from this. I think this is a composer having so much fun and doing something that, inverted commas, shouldn't be doing. It reminds me to remind people, you have to create what you want to create, what's really in your heart, what you're finding fun, because that'll be the most original and the best thing that you'll do.
And do you ever find, which I think composers do when something's going really wonderfully, that it begins to write itself?
Yeah, I think you have that moment of, I suddenly know exactly what I'm doing. I don't know whether anyone's going to like it, but I know what I'm doing. and it feels right and it's flowing.
I'm sure Saint-Saëns did have fun writing that, and it was brilliant to use the double bass on the piano, because you don't often hear solos for double bass.
Sure. See, my lack of knowledge, that's you telling me.
But the Elephant from the Carnival of the Animals by Saint-Saëns, and performed by Antonio Pappano on the piano and Libero Lanzilotta on the double bass. You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest today is the writer and comedian Miranda Hart. You had a leading role in Call the Midwife, Miranda. It was about a group of nurse midwives working in the East End of London in the late 50s, 60s. At the time, one of the most popular dramas on British television. Did you enjoy that period?
Oh, I loved it. Absolutely loved it, because I'd been writing my own material to give myself my own parts for, you know, most of my career. And so suddenly to be given a part that I didn't have to write. Jennifer Wirth, who wrote the books, sent me a copy of the book a few weeks before she died. And she said, this is going to be made into television and you remind me of my friend Chummy. And I hope you get to play her. And I read the description of her and I thought, I've got to play this. And then I read the script and Heidi Thomas's writing was just so beautiful. Mm. And there was a bit of pressure to that as well, because this was a real character and you wanted to honour that. But the joy of not having to get a laugh was just playing just real. I mean, that's why they say comedy is harder. So actually, yeah, it was a shift, but I didn't find it too difficult.
She was a gentle soul, Chummy, wasn't she?
Yes, and yeah. I love portraying a vulnerability and a gentleness and the importance of those qualities, the importance of that gentle kindness, and that we don't all have to be extroverts and make our mark in that way. She was had a similar vulnerability to the Miranda character, I realised. She was also a fish out of water and she'd come from upper-class background into the East End and was incredibly brave.
So that was, I was going to say, that was a new mountain you climbed.
Very good.
On the way to our next piece of music, but I think that's too obvious.
No, I like it.
So it is Climb Every Mountain from Rodgers and Hammerstein, Sound of Music.
Yes.
What made you choose this?
Well, first of all, my love of musicals, and I absolutely love The Sound of Music. I watched it from a very young age, over and over again. And as a young, awkward, shy teenager, I think I just wanted to be a Maria who was searching for what she wanted to do. And I thought, yeah, well, that's what I feel. I'm searching. And so this song to me is, to some might seem rather naff or trite to say, follow your dream and make sure you love it and nurture it for the rest of your life. But dreams are really important, not just as a naff kind of follow your dream, but as in who you really are and what your purpose is. Follow what your unique skills are and why you're on this planet.
It's also a lovely tune.
And actually, the other reason I chose this is that we sang it. I had a very small wedding, about 35, 40 people, and we sang it all together at the end. And initially we were going, are we really going to do this? This is such a naff idea. And I was like, yeah, we're committing, we're going to do it. And the minute everyone started singing, people got so emotional and really going for it, and suddenly the beauty of the song. So now it just makes me cry because I think of a happy day of my life as well.
Climb every mountain,
Climb Every Mountain by Rodgers and Hammerstein, performed by Peggy Wood and conducted by Erwin Kostel. When you hear that, does it bring back many emotional thoughts?
Yeah, it does. It makes me think of the recent joy of getting married, which I had sort of given up on the possibility of, and also that young me dreaming. You know, I've always been a dreamer. So, yeah, it's very emotional. It's a beautiful song.
You've starred, Miranda Hart, in several movies. Nancy and Spy.
Oh, yes.
Directed by Paul Feig. Working for the CIA.
Yes. I was playing a techno sort of nerd. Yeah, so suddenly I was having my first sort of Hollywood experience. Melissa McCarthy was it, Jude Law was in it, Jason Statham. It was an amazing experience.
In 2020, you played Miss Bates in Jane Austen's Emma, directed by Autumn de Wilde. Costume drama, was that fun?
Yes, it was. I did feel a pressure, though, of playing that character, because obviously she's much loved and had been played by brilliant actors before. But yes, I did enjoy stepping into that world. It's something I thought I'd never do. And it was Autumn's 6'2", and used to be a ballerina and also had the journey of putting on a lot of weight and changing identity. So we shared that, and she really wanted to put a non-slight woman into a period drama, which for me was just made so much sense.
Autumn de Wilde was nice to you, but Emma is not so nice to Miss Chatterbox.
No, and there's that very definitive scene, picnic scene, where Emma is mean to Miss Bates, and Miss Bates's reaction is so important in that. She needs to be heard for the rest of this Emma's story to make sense and really resonate. So that's probably the most nervous I've ever been on set, was thinking, I've got to get this right. This is vital for the story. And I did the take, and Autumn and a couple of producers came out in tears, and I went, yes, I've done it, I've got them.
Grieg next. It's the piano concerto in A minor.
Yes, I discovered this from Morecambe and Wise, from their famous sketch, recording it with Andrew Preview, as they called him. And so I've always seen this as almost like, isn't this a comedy song? Because that introduction, it just makes me laugh, because I can just see Eric Morecambe trying to get to the piano in time. For those who don't know the sketch, you must get it on YouTube. And Andrew Preview was absolutely brilliant in it and had comic timing that surprised Eric Morecambe immensely, because Eric Morecambe was incredibly worried about this sketch. They didn't have much rehearsal. So I've since listened to it and carried on listening beyond that beginning bit that just makes me laugh. I thought, wow, this is a really fascinating piece of music. It sort of goes everywhere. It makes me think, oh, I'm feeling every emotion, and now where's it taking me, and what's it saying? I find it absolutely fascinating, so I've got a new relationship with it now.
Thank you.
quite a dramatic piece, isn't it?
Yeah, really dramatic. Mm. It's not the comedy I thought it was. The comedy tune.
The Allegro from the Piano Concerto in A Minor, composed by Edward Grieg and performed by Alice Sarah Ott with the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Esa-Pekka Salonen. Miranda Hart, your latest book is called I Haven't Been Entirely Honest With You, and in it you describe how, alongside all of your achievements, you've battled chronic illness, and you document how you felt you weren't listened to, and that must resonate with an awful lot of people.
Yeah, I think so. I think with chronic conditions, because you've got sort of nebulous symptoms like fatigue or, you know, I've got pain or... It's very hard to get across, and then I think, as a Brit, it's often you fib, complaining, or you're saying the same things over and over again. But yet, when your standard blood tests come back normal or they can't find anything wrong, you sort of say, oh, it's probably just stress. And you know in your bones it's, I mean, literal and metaphorical bones, it's not. So, yeah, I think being misunderstood and then just having to keep going on your own is one of the hardest... They call it chronic invisible illness now for a reason, yeah.
So how long did this go on for?
Really... Since I was 15, I've not felt well. And then I only got the diagnosis 3 or 4 years ago.
How do you get, or how do you think you got, Lyme disease?
We're pretty sure I would have got it when I was 14 or 15, which happened to be when my father was working in Washington, D.C. And so I lived out there. And West Virginia is a Lyme hotspot. And I remember a time when I had what felt like flu. And it kind of went on a bit longer than normal. And so we think it must have been then, and it just wasn't picked up and would have remained in my system.
You've written the book very much from the point of view of helping people come to terms with illness, because you read a lot of self-help books, and this is, in a way, a self-help book.
Yeah, in a way, it's a story of the discovery, for me, of actually what the self-help and wellness industry was saying, what actually were the kind of... key scientific principles to kind of living holistically well. Because if I wasn't going to get better, if I wasn't going to get a diagnosis, then I wanted to know how to do the next 10 minutes, how to find some joy and meaning in my day. And so I researched and researched, and then I felt like I had these treasures, as I call them, and I couldn't not share them.
Give me an example of the treasures.
Well, play and joy is one of them. You know, years and years of chronic illness or being misunderstood, I found that my personal everyday joy was going, because it's such an effort to get through each day and not knowing why became quite scary. So nurturing play and joy in adulthood, lots of people can resonate with. The hardest one was the concept of surrender and acceptance to what you're experiencing, because every instinct goes to fight it and fix it and it not be acceptable and just, oh, I can't bear it or be angry with it. And that, of course, is exactly not what your body needs to get better. So to learn to accept and be patient and go, well, this is what I have, was for me very, very difficult. I think I'm quite an impatient person. I want to get on, and I want to plan and do things. And again, I think that's resonated with a lot of people.
Well, you talk also about finding your authentic self, and I wonder how you do that, especially if you're a person of so many parts and characters.
Well, I think we all are. What I discovered perhaps was that I was only portraying one part of me. That was the professionally competent, socially competent, independent, strong, hopefully wise at times person. Whereas I was denying the fact that, as all humans are, I am also vulnerable and fragile and need to ask for help. So I feel like I've become more honestly myself.
A beautiful song next.
Yeah, Cornwall My Home by Fisherman's Friends. And it actually really speaks to that being truly yourself, actually, because the reason I love it is the sense of belonging, the absolute sense of connection they have to their land. Us humans are wired intrinsically to belong, not just to survive, but to thrive. And so I find it very moving from that point of view, this absolute key sense of belonging and love for each other.
I stood on Cape Cornwall in the sun's evening glow, June Hill at Newland, to watch the fishing fleets go, watch the sheave whales and keevers as they spun around, and heard the men singing as they go underground.
and no one will ever move me from this land until the Lord calls me to sit at his hand. For this is my Eden, and I'm not alone. For this is my
I've left childish footsteps in the soft sand and sand. I've chased the maze there on Pickley and Tan. I've stood on a cliff top in a westerly blow and heard the waves thunder rocks far below,
and no one will ever move me from this land until the Lord calls me to sit at his hand. For this is my Eden, and I'm not alone. For this is my call.
In the morning on Chapel Cambrai, to gaze at the ceilings in the blue far away. For this is my Cornwall, and I'll tell you why.
Because I was born here, here I shall die, and no one will ever move me from this land until the Lord calls me to sit at his hand. For this is my Eden, and I'm not alone. For this is my call.
Cornwall, My Home, composed by Harry Glasson and performed by The Fisherman's Friends. I have to say, Miranda Hart, as you began to join in there, I noticed quite a lovely voice.
Well, that means a lot, because one of my dreams would be to sing, and to sing really well.
You have done musicals, though.
I have. I played Miss Hannigan in Annie, and I think I just got away with it, because she was a character part. But I'm hoping that my voice will open up one day. I think there's a lot of anxiety and fear around singing. It's very exposing.
Another thing you admit to yourself in the book is that you don't want to be alone, and after years of playing someone single, was that rather a vulnerable thing to say out loud?
Yeah, I whispered it to myself. I'll never forget it. I was very ill, and I had terrible light sensitivity, which is one of the symptoms of Lyme, and I couldn't often open the curtains till about 4 p.m. because everything was too light. And I just thought, gosh, this is really tough. And I just sort of almost like put up a little prayer and said, I just don't want to be on my own anymore. And I think when you long for something, it's incredibly hard because you then, of course, have to feel what's missing. I now see it was a turning point. When you open up to that and admit what you long for, it's the only really way you can begin to find it. And during lockdown, I had to leave, well, just before lockdown, I had to leave my house because my immune system wasn't coping with the mould. So this man came in as the project manager to deal with my rising damp. There are lots of jokes going on. I'm sure to be had there. We won't go there. It's too good quality a show for that. So thanks to my illness and COVID and all sorts of things, I met this man that I fell in love with.
Congratulations are in order.
But
did he sort out the rising damp?
Yes, most importantly, he was a very, very kind, gentle soul that took the job on because he said, I know what this building industry can be like, and I want to protect you. Which I thought, before I knew that he'd end up being my husband, was just, I thought, was an amazing quality.
Sweet Georgia Brown.
Yes. So this is my husband's influence. So he's the drummer and has introduced me to jazz, which I'm not entirely fond of. Let's just pretend he won't hear this. I get anxious when they go off on one and when they improvise, and I suddenly go, what am I listening to? What are you doing this? Are you doing this for an audience or for yourself? And it makes me think of my comedy, because I am very scripted and structured with comedy, and therefore it feels, I hope, improvisational. So this, Sweet Georgia Brown, was combining the structure of classical with the improvisational Grappelli jazz violinist. And so I found this absolutely fascinating that Yehudi Menuhin said, OK, I will try and bring some of this improvisational, slightly chaotic feel, as long as it's within a structure. And combining those two genres I find fascinating. And it's just so much fun as well.
Sweet Georgia Brown. We heard Yehudi Menuhin and Stefan Grappelli. It was arranged by Max Harris, who also directed it. You're obsessed with Strictly Come Dancing, Miranda Hart. Sarah Hadland, who played Stevie, your best friend in Miranda, took part in the most recent series.
Yes, yeah, she got to the final. So she did amazingly, and it was thrilling for me to watch Strictly as a super fan with a friend in it, made my autumn absolutely glorious. I just love watching dance, basically.
Did you have lots of advice to offer?
Yes, obviously, as a natural dancer myself, I was constantly giving tips.
I think water-related activity is more your thing.
Yeah, that made me think of synchronised swimming for some reason, dancing and water. Perhaps that's what I should do. I feel at peace when I'm sitting by a river or by the sea. I love nothing more than being in, on, or by water. It is kind of bodily where I do feel, I mean, I admire dancers so much, they're like athletes, I think it's an incredibly vulnerable thing to do. So for me, when I swim, I do sort of flail around and do big movements. I love it, that sort of weightless feeling.
You
like an elephant.
Yes.
In a,
Well, sadly, we've come to the final track, so you must tell me what it is.
We've had the silliness in comedy, we're back now to the melancholy. And the more sort of spiritual, I suppose, for want of a better word, the joy that can be found in the serious and the joy that can be found in darkness, which I suppose is what my book was about. I mean, the composer is wanting us to feel a real inner peace and joy. He's writing about the birth of Jesus. He's writing about incarnation. And I share that faith, so it speaks to me on that level too. But it's just a true acceptance of it's okay to feel how you're feeling.
Omanium Mysterium, composed by Morten Lauritsen. So it only remains for me, Miranda Hart, thank you very, very much indeed.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it, and I look forward to, genuinely look forward to my homework to learn more. So thank you.
You're on.